Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 209. It's Monday, May 1st. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I want to get right to it with some reporting on the health status in Ohio. So the Health Policy Institute of Ohio every year puts out their health value dashboard, which is dozens of metrics about public health and healthcare spending. Well, unfortunately, Ohio ranks 44th out of the 50 states and DC. So 51 is the worst. I'm just going to go through, actually, there's only one good one I'm going to report on where we're in the top 10, which is better. But ones that hit 40 or worse, I'll give you a little flavoring here. The first category is population health. We rank 44th in adult smoking at 18% of adults who smoke. 40th in the prevalence of adult diabetes at 12.6%. 41st in heart disease mortality. 47th in drug overdose deaths. Yikes. 41st in infant mortality, 41st in limited activity due to health problems, so a measure of disability. And in the category of healthcare spending, we rank 47th in total out-of-pocket spending. Yikes, those are people who actually spend more than 10% of their annual income on out-of-pocket expenses. We rank 47th. 41st on employer-sponsored health insurance outpatient spending per enrollee at almost $2,000 per person. Ranked 46th on average monthly marketplace premium. So this would be the Affordable Care Act marketplace. 46th among states. Yikes. 42nd on total Medicare spending per beneficiary. So this is one of the things that drives the lower rankings, that we spend a lot of money on healthcare, but we're not getting good public health outcomes. So in access to care, here's a 50th ranking. Not quite the worst, because you can get 51 is the worst, but ranked 50th on preventive dental care for children. Not a good sign. And on the healthcare system, and the effectiveness, 43rd on colon and rectal cancer early stage diagnosis, 41st on heart failure admissions for Medicare beneficiaries, and 41st on potentially avoidable emergency department visits for employer-insured enrollees. So this is just a measure of kind of the quality of both prevention in the community, but also these are ones that are things that could be prevented within the hospital system where there's failure, so you got lower quality. Ranked 43rd in primary care physicians. This is the ratio comparing the number of specialist physicians to the number of primary care physicians. So this means that we have a lot of specialist physicians per primary care physician, which tends to mean you're going to have more specialist care and less primary care, preventive care. Okay. In the public health and prevention sector, we rank 48th on state public health workforce. This is the number of full-time equivalents in, for instance, the state health department. But we do actually, our highest ranking of any of these dozens and dozens and dozens of metrics, we ranked number 2 in the accreditation of local health departments. Now, they didn't rate the local public health workforce at 48th ranking with state public health workforce, but we do have data. The local public health department spending per capita, $21.40. Of course, this would be a lot less than what a lot of millages that you would see that we vote on for a whole variety of things. So if you're being critical of public health, remember we're only spending about $20 per capita. So adjust your expectations accordingly. But Ohio is highly accredited, which is a good process. But of course, you can be fully accredited but completely underfunded. We rank 41st in environmental and occupational health. This means actions to maintain and secure the safety of water and food supplies, to test for hazards and contaminants in the environment, and to protect workers and emergency responders from health hazards. Ranked 41st in that. We rank 43rd in seatbelt use at 84%. Rank 44th in emergency preparedness funding per capita. 51st, dead last, in health security surveillance. And this is actions to monitor and detect health threats and identify where hazards start and spread so they contain rapidly. Of course, this one is actually going to be highly correlated with the state and local public health workforce doing this type of surveillance and investigations. If you don't have people to do that, it isn't going to happen. Ranked 51st, dead last in health security surveillance. Not a good public health indicator. And then under the category of social and economic environment, we rank 40th in the rate of incarceration. Let's see, is there one more? Yes, I'm sorry. Physical environment, oh boy, even more bad news. So in this subcategory of air, water, and toxic substance, we rank 50th. We rank 41st in outdoor air quality. We rank 47th in a child in a household with a person who smokes, which is a huge cause. The largest cause of indoor air pollution is smoking. And we rank 50th in toxic pollutants. Yikes. And we also under physical environment, we rank 40th among the 50 states and D.C. in food insecurity. This is the percent of households that are food insecure, 11.6%. So Ohio ranks 44th overall. We have a long way to go. Maybe we will get the award for most improved. Let's work for that. Okay, well, let's get to some good news nationally. This from Medical Express. U.S. adult cigarette smoking rate hits new all-time low. U.S. cigarette smoking dropped to another all-time low last year, with 1 in 9 adults saying they were current smokers, according to a government survey data released last Thursday. Meanwhile, electronic cigarette use rose from about 1 in 17 adults. The preliminary findings of the CDC are based on survey responses from more than 27,000 adults. Cigarette smoking is a risk factor for lung cancer, heart disease, and stroke, and it's long been considered the leading cause of preventable death. In the mid-1960s, 42% of U.S. adults were smokers. The rate has been gradually dropping for decades due to cigarette taxes, tobacco product price hikes, smoking bans, and changes in the social acceptability of lighting up in public. Last year, the percentage of adult smokers dropped to about 11%, down from about 12.5% in 2020 and 2021. E-cigarette use rose to nearly 6% last year from about 4.5% the year before. The rise in e-cigarette use concerns Dr. Jonathan Samet, dean of the Colorado School of Public Health. Nicotine addiction has its own health implications, including risk of high blood pressure and narrowing of the arteries, according to the American Heart Association. I would also add that the whole slew of chemicals that's present in e-cigarettes has also been shown to be on par, particularly causing lung damage in e-cigarette users. I think that smoking will continue to ebb downwards, but whether the prevalence of nicotine addiction will drop, given the rise of electronic products, is not clear, said Samet, who has been a contributing author to U.S. Surgeon General reports on smoking and health for almost 4 decades. Smoking and vaping rates are almost reversed for teens. Only about 2% of high school students were smoking traditional cigarettes last year, but about 14% were using e-cigarettes, according to other CDC data. Okay, well, let's switch gears. Let's talk about the leading cause of death among youth. That would be weapons, guns. This from The Hill. More voters support assault weapons bans over arming citizens to reduce violence. More U.S. voters support banning assault weapons over arming citizens to reduce gun violence, according to a Fox News poll released last Thursday. While 45% of those surveyed said they would encourage more citizens to carry guns to defend against attackers, 61% said they favored banning assault rifles and semi-automatic weapons. Huge majorities in the poll also supported a wide variety of gun safety measures, including 87% who say they backed requiring background checks for all gun purchases. Another 81% supported improving enforcement of gun laws and raising the legal minimum age to buy guns to 21. 8 in 10 also said that mental health checks should be required for all gun buyers, and that police should temporarily be able to take guns away from people who have been shown to be a danger to themselves or others. However, despite widespread support for such measures, only 43% said stricter gun control laws would make the country safer, while one quarter said it would make the U.S. less safe, the poll found. Renewed discussion about gun safety laws comes as the U.S. continues to reel from almost daily mass shootings. There have been 172 mass shootings so far in 2023, according to the Gun Violence Archive. And of course, since that's more than one a day, you know, even if this is a number of days old, you have to bump that number of 172 up probably at least a half a dozen or so for what the number is today. I do find one of the most interesting, unfortunately, discouraging is that the only 43% said stricter gun control laws would make the country safer, even though there's wide support for that. And I think that's partly because there is an understanding among the public that we have gone so far with gun access and the widespread presence of guns that even doing strict gun control now would have kind of a blunted response, the ability to roll back some of the danger zone that we are already in. Okay, next up, a story on an issue that's a little bit obscure, but more obscure than it should be. This from MedPage Today. Awareness of HPV's link to cancer lags as cases continue to increase. Awareness of the association with HPV infection and cancer has declined, even as the number of cases of HPV-related cancers continues to increase, a National Health Trends survey showed. From 2014 to 2020, the proportion of survey respondents who knew that HPV causes cervical cancer declined from 77.6% to 70.2%. Awareness of HPV's association with other cancers lagged far behind, in the high 20s or low 30%. In general, awareness of the viruses linked to oral, anal, and penile cancers changed little across the five study periods. The findings have major public health implications, as studies have shown that awareness of the HPV cancer relationship is associated with the uptake of the HPV vaccine, said Eric Bokeh at the American Association of Cancer Research annual meeting. The implications going forward are that there is a need to increase awareness and also to target interventions to increase awareness and counteract HPV vaccine disinformation, which is very prevalent, he said. If we don't do that, there is a very high risk that we will not meet the Healthy People 2023 goal for HPV vaccination, which is 80%. We are now at 62%. Traditionally, the vaccination rate has only been increasing about 2% or 1% per year. The awareness levels might actually have been overestimated, Bokeh continued. Only survey participants who said they had heard of HPV, about 70% of those surveyed, were asked about their awareness of the virus's association with cancer. Obviously, you don't even know what HPV is. It's kind of hard to know that it has an association with cancer. So those numbers are even lower. And if you look at that, that means less than half the people are aware that HPV causes cervical cancer. That's the primary cancer it's associated with. The lagging awareness is concerning because HPV-positive oropharyngeal cancer and anal cancer are two of the cancers that are still increasing in incidence in the United States, he noted. It is important to emphasize that HPV cancers can be entirely prevented with vaccination. Because of the recent focus on COVID, it is hard for me to really be concerned about these numbers except for the fact that so few know this information, said Lois Ramondetta of the University of Texas Cancer Center. The concerning thing is that with 80% of the world's population being exposed to a virus that causes 6 to 7 cancers, and for them not to know, it is a heartbreaking realization regarding health education. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a story that's actually more of a case study than the importance of the content itself. This from MedPage Today. Bell's palsy occurred more frequently with COVID vaccines. Now, first, if you just look at that headline, it gives you the impression that COVID vaccines, you know, have this side effect that's really significant. But if you read the first paragraph of the article, it says, people who received a COVID vaccine were more likely to develop Bell's palsy than those who weren't vaccinated, but the risk of Bell's palsy was higher among people with SARS-CoV-2 infection, a systematic review and meta-analysis showed. So the headline tends to speak against the COVID vaccines, but like in many cases where this, where side effects have been elucidated, actually getting the COVID infection is more risky than getting the vaccine. But if you're looking at one without the other, it gives you kind of a misimpression, so it can be misleading. Okay, compared with vaccination, however, the SARS-CoV-2 infection tripled the risk of developing Bell's palsy. The occurrence of Bell's palsy did not vary among different vaccines. These findings show that the benefits of vaccinating against SARS-CoV-2 enormously outweigh the potential risk of developing Bell's palsy. Considering Bell's palsy is the adverse event, SARS-CoV-2 infection is associated with a 3.2-fold increase in Bell's palsy risk compared to vaccination. Bell's palsy is a form of temporary paralysis or weakness on one side of the face. Symptoms appear suddenly over a few days and usually start to improve after a few weeks. Okay, next up is sort of a case study report too, getting at the importance of the FDA's regulation of food supplements and food, and frankly how poor that is, and oversight is not very good. This from The Hill. Melatonin levels in some gummies don't match labels, study finds. A new study has revealed that melatonin gummies advertised to help with sleep may have potentially harmful levels of the hormone, as well as cannabidiol, CBD, which is not labeled on the packaging. A study published in the medical journal JAMA investigated 25 different gummy brands that were labeled with melatonin and were also listed in the National Institute of Health's Dietary Supplement Label Database. The study found that 88% of the gummies investigated were inaccurately labeled, with only 12% containing within 10% of the quantity that was labeled. One of the products that was labeled as including melatonin was actually found to have no traces of the hormone, but contained 31 milligrams of CBD. The amount of CBD found across all 25 of the products ranged from 11 to 31 milligrams, but only 5 products included CBD on the label. The study found that the actual quantity of CBD in the gummies ranged from 104 to 118% of the labeled amount. According to the Food and Drug Administration, is it currently illegal to market CBD by adding it to a food or labeling it as a dietary supplement? The FDA did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The study said that about 1.3% of children in the United States use melatonin for sleep and relaxation concerns before the COVID-19 pandemic, which could place them at risk for ingesting potentially high amounts of melatonin. Melatonin gummies could also resemble candy, which could result in accidental ingestion by children. The study noted that from 2012 to 2021, the number of calls for children ingesting melatonin to the Poison Control Center increased 530%. During that same period, over 4,000 hospitalizations, almost 300 intensive care unit admissions, and 2 deaths were associated with pediatric ingestion of melatonin. So this is another area where there needs to be much better surveillance and testing required of people that are manufacturing dietary supplements. Okay, next up, a story on drinking and driving among older folks. This from Medical Express. Older drivers drinking or using drugs up to 4 times likelier to be at fault during a car crash. Substance use among older drivers increases the probability of them being at fault 2 to 4 times during a crash, a new study analyzing 9 years worth of U.S. nationwide highway traffic data shows. Although older drivers are less likely to report using substances, this research found out that of a sample of 87,000 drivers involved in 2 moving vehicle crashes, more than one-third were motorists over the age 70 who tested positive for substances. In general, older drivers are at an elevated risk for being at fault in a fatal car crash. This is especially the case when they are under the influence of alcohol or drugs, explained the lead author, Dr. Satish Kadia, professor at the University of Memphis School of Public Health. In 2020, there were almost 48 million licensed drivers aged 65 and older in the United States. This is a 68% increase since 2000. And in 2020, about 7,500 seniors died in collisions, while nearly 200,000 others were injured. The study found that substance use in general disproportionately increased the probability of being at fault during a crash, regardless of driver's age. The regression models, even after adjusting for driver's sex, road grade, weather, light conditions, distraction, and speeding at time of crash, revealed that older substance-impaired drivers were twice as likely to be at fault in fatal crashes. Some of the key takeaways of the study include the need for campaigns to raise awareness about the risk of impaired driving tailored to older adults. Another implication is that healthcare professionals and prevention specialists trying to develop best practices for deterring drug driving must ensure that their interventions efforts address the specific needs of older adults. This will include emphasis on the danger of unforeseen drug interactions, especially the dangerous interactions between many prescription medications and alcohol that can compromise drivers' motor skills and reaction time. The research team's suggestion for policymakers include implementing some common sense steps, such as increasing visibility cues, such as markings on the road, dedicated left turn lanes, and signals at intersections on public roads, making it easier for older drivers with visual limitations. Blind spot detection, automatic pretensioners and seatbelts, and similar technology being built into newer model cars will also aid these efforts. A shortened licensing renewal cycle for drivers over 65, with in-person vision and knowledge tests and referrals for assessment of cognitive and functional abilities might also be a consideration. I know that it's important for seniors to have a sense of independence, and driving helps them with the overall quality of life, Cadilla said. However, our findings indicate the need for a concerted effort to prevent both drunk and drug driving for all age groups, especially among older adults. Specific to limited driving while intoxicated, evidence suggests that the most effective deterrents are strong DWI laws, enforcement of such laws, and the regular use of sobriety checkpoints. These strategies would ideally be accompanied by educational interventions to increase knowledge of the laws and the risks of impaired driving for all ages. Obviously, we do not want to dissuade older people from driving, but knowing the risks involved and taking precautions can help everyone. We just want to persuade them to drive safely for the sake of themselves and others, said Dr. Cadilla. And in other injury-related news, this from Medical Express, 45% of people with concussions still show symptoms of brain injury 6 months later. Even mild concussion can cause long-lasting effects of the brain, according to researchers at the University of Cambridge. Using data from a Europe-wide study, the team has shown that for almost half of all people who receive a knock on the head, there are changes to how regions of the brain communicate with each other, potentially causing long-term symptoms such as fatigue and cognitive impairment. Mild traumatic brain injury, a concussion, results from a blow or jolt to the head. It can occur as a result of a fall, a sports injury, or from a cycling accident or a car crash, for example. But despite being labeled mild, it is commonly linked with persistent symptoms and incomplete recovery. Such symptoms include depression, cognitive impairment, headaches, and fatigue. While some clinicians in recent studies predict that 9 out of 10 individuals who experience concussion will have a full recovery after 6 months, evidence is emerging that only a half achieve a full recovery. This means that a significant proportion of patients may not receive adequate post-injury care. Predicting which patients will have a fast recovery and who will take longer to recover is challenging, however. At present, patients with suspected concussion are typically given a brain scan, either a CT scan or an MRI scan, both of which look for structural problems, such as inflammation or bruising. Yet even if these scans show no obvious structural damage, a patient's symptoms may still persist. Dr. Emmanuel Stamatakis from the Department of Clinical Neurosciences and Division of Anesthesia at the University of Cambridge said, "Worldwide, we're seeing an increase in the number of cases of mild traumatic brain injury, particularly from falls in our aging population, and rising numbers of road traffic collisions in low- and middle-income countries. At present, we have no clear way of working out which of these patients will have a speedy recovery which will take longer, and the combination of over-optimistic and imprecise prognosis means that some patients risk not receiving adequate care for their symptoms." Okay, next up, we have an interesting story that gets at how government investment may serve the public health or private wealth. This from Medical Express. Study shows NIH investment in new drug approvals is comparable to investment by pharmaceutical industry. The National Institutes of Health spent $187 billion for basic or applied research related to 354 of the 356 drugs approved by the FDA from 2010 to 2019, according to a new study from Bentley University Center for Integration of Science and Industry. The study published in JAMA Health Forum shows that the amount invested per approved drug by the NIH is comparable to that reported investment by the biopharmaceutical industry. The article titled Comparison of Research Spending on New Drug Approvals by the U.S. National Institutes of Health versus Industry, 2010 to 2019, is the first to compare the total value of NIH and industry investments, taking into account actual spending on research related to approved products and failed product candidates, as well as the time value of these investments. Our analysis shows that at least half of the total investment in research and development required to bring a product to market comes from the U.S. government, said Fred Ledley, director of the Center for Integration of Science and Industry and the senior author of the study. If taxpayers are investing as much as shareholders in bringing drugs to market, then the public could expect social or economic returns commensurate with those of pharmaceutical companies or their shareholders. Industry has been criticized for high drug prices that make needed drugs unavailable to some patients. While industry claims that high drug prices are justified by the cost of bringing these drugs to market, the present work suggests that the public interest of these products should be balanced with corporate interests. So this is a great first-time study that shows that the public investment is even more than what the private invested is, so the public should certainly gain the benefit of that investment. But to also show how the pharmaceutical industry works, I would remind you that the pharmaceutical industry spends more on marketing than they do on research. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up, let's do some healthcare reporting, particularly a few stories here on Medicaid. First up from Stat News, Biden officials propose slate of Medicaid transparency changes. The Biden administration last Thursday rolled out proposals to set national standards for care in Medicaid and children's health care plans amid upheavals for millions of Americans' coverage in both programs. A pair of draft rules released by federal health officials would require Medicaid plans to book enrollees for appointments within 2 weeks. The rule would also require states to track and report the quality of care patients receive, to share provider payment rates, and to oversee these changes through secret shopper surveys. However, while the agency proposed a slew of reporting requirements, the change did not come with clear penalties or incentives for improving wait time and care. The draft plans come as states reassess Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program enrollment in the wake of the COVID-19 emergency ending. Congress allowed states to begin removing people from Medicaid rolls this month, ending a pandemic freeze that saw Medicaid coverage balloon more than 20 million new enrollees. An estimated 18 million people could lose coverage in the next year, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation survey of state Medicaid programs. Biden officials said during a briefing that the proposed changes would help bring Medicare in line with similar rate reporting in Medicare and care expectations in commercial plans. We are proposing to line up a floor on appointment timeliness with what actually exists for commercial plans in the marketplace, said Medicaid and CHIP Director Dan Tsai. Also, if the rule is finalized, every state has to benchmark their base rates for Medicaid relative to Medicare payment rates, which is a national standard that allows for comparison and easy benchmarking across states, he said. And in more reporting on this from Axios, some additional things that be required in these regs. They would ensure that at least 80% of Medicaid payments for home health care be spent on compensation for those direct care workers instead of on overhead or taken as profits. They would require states to publish wait lists for home care services, putting numbers to long wait time residents looking for services experience. And they would compel states to publish average hourly wage data for direct care workers offering services in their state. So I love the one to ensure at least 80% of Medicaid patients payments for home health care be spent on compensation for those direct care workers instead of overhead or taken as profits. Of course, if you look at what was once traditional Medicaid, not this farmed out to private companies, and the same with Medicare before it's been farmed out to Medicare Advantage plans, you're talking low single digits in the amount of overhead that's actually expended on administering those plans. But as soon as you privatize those plans, you have a hard time keeping the overhead and profits under 20%. Okay, next up, another Medicaid story, and this one regarding enrollment among immigrant children. And it's a good example of how other public policies can impact public health. This from Medical Express. Medicaid enrollment among immigrant children is higher in sanctuary states. Low-income immigrant children in sanctuary states were nearly 10% more likely to be enrolled in Medicaid in the years following the 2018 announcement of the revised, quote, public charge rule, according to a new national study. Researchers examined trends in children's Medicaid enrollment in sanctuary states, states that limit collaboration with federal immigration and customs enforcement personnel. Researchers explored Medicaid enrollment rates among low-income immigrant children following a 2018 federal rule denying immigrants permanent residency based on participation in public programs, including Medicaid for adults, but not for children. Of course, children live with adults who are denied this, and of course, are subject to the same or even more risks regarding immigration status. Researchers found that Medicaid enrollment among low-income immigrant children in sanctuary states increased after the 2018 rule update. Medicaid enrollment rates among low-income immigrant children for non-sanctuary states decreased during the same period. Federal immigration policies can serve as political determinants of health, denying children and immigrant families access to health insurance and medical care, said Marion Ayan Aibo, medical student at Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and presenting author. States can break barriers to care that federal immigration policies create and ensure every child receives the care they need. So we need to de-link or get rid of these punishing type of laws in order to access appropriate public health for all of our children. Of course, this kind of problem would be well addressed if you had health care for all, with everybody in and nobody out, and not these dozens of tiers and complications in what it takes to actually access health care.
It started in Norway in 1912. And they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I want to close out my regular reporting with a couple stories on artificial intelligence in healthcare. I've been reporting a lot on this. It's amazing how much there's been kind of a wave of reporting on this, but let's do a couple stories on that. First up from MedPage Today. ChatGPT answers beat physicians on info patient empathy study finds. The artificial intelligence chatbot ChatGPT outperformed physicians when answering patient questions based on quality of response and empathy, according to a cross-sectional study. The AI chatbot responses were given a significantly higher quality rating than physician responses, with a proportion of responses rated as good or very good quality over four times higher for ChatGPT than physicians, with 79% rated that high for ChatGPT compared to physicians at 22%, amounting to a 3.6 times higher prevalence of good or very good quality responses for the chatbot, they noted in JAMA Internal Medicine. Furthermore, ChatGPT's responses were rated as being significantly more empathetic than physician responses, with a proportion of responses rated as empathetic or very empathetic over four times higher for ChatGPT at 45% than for physicians at less than 5%, amounting to a 10 times higher prevalence of empathetic or very empathetic responses for the chatbot. He said they were trying to figure out how ChatGPT could potentially help resolve the burden of answering patient messages for physicians, which he noted is a well-documented contributor to burnout. The burnout crisis might be affecting roughly 1.1 million providers across the U.S., but is also affecting about 329 million patients who are engaging with overburdened healthcare professionals. There are a lot of people out there asking questions that may be going unanswered or get bad answers. What do you do to help them? I think AI-assisted messaging could be a game changer for public health. He noted that AI-assisted messaging could change patient outcomes, and he wants to see more studies that focus on evaluating these outcomes. He said he hopes this study will motivate more research on this issue of AI because of its potential to improve productivity and free up time of clinical staff for more complex tasks. In an accompanying perspective, Teva Brender of the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine wrote that the promise of AI to ease the burden of documentation and other common, often repetitive written tasks should be weighed against the potential harm such as adding to, quote, note bloat or exacerbating existing biases. Physicians will need to learn how to integrate these tools into clinical practice, defining clear boundaries between full, supervised, and prescribed autonomy. And yet, I am cautiously optimistic about a future of improved healthcare system efficiency, better patient outcomes, and reduced burnout. Okay, well, let's delve into this AI and healthcare issue a little more deeply. This from Stat News. A research team airs the messy truth about AI in medicine and gives hospitals a guide to fix it. In public, hospitals rave about artificial intelligence. They trumpet the technology in press releases, plaster its use on billboards, and sprinkle AI into speeches touting its ability to detect diseases earlier and make healthcare faster, cheaper, and better. But on the front lines, the hype is smashing into a starkly different reality. Caregivers complain AI models are unreliable and of limited value. Tools designed to warn of impending illness are inconsistent and sometimes difficult to interpret. Even evaluating them for accuracy and susceptibility to bias is still an unsettled science. A new report aims to drag these tensions into the open through interviews with physicians and data scientists struggling to implement AI tools in healthcare organizations nationwide. Their unvarnished reviews, compiled by researchers at Duke University, reveal a yawning gap between the marketing of AI and the months, sometimes years, of toil it takes to get the technology to work the right way in the real world. I don't think we even really have a great understanding of how to measure an algorithm's performance, let alone its performance across different race and ethnic groups, one interview subject told researchers. The interviews, kept anonymous to allow for candor, were conducted at a dozen healthcare organizations, including insurers and large academic hospitals, such as Mayo Clinic, Kaiser Permanente, New York Presbyterian, and the University of California, San Francisco. The research team, dubbed the Health AI Partnership, has leveraged the findings to build an online guide to help health systems overcome implementation barriers that most organizations now stumble through alone. It's a desperately needed service at a time when adoption of AI for decision-making in medicine is outpacing efforts to oversee its use. The challenges uncovered by the project point to a dawning realization about AI's use in healthcare. Building the algorithm is the easiest part of the work. The real difficulty lies in figuring out how to incorporate the technology into the daily routines of doctors and nurses and the complicated care delivery and technical systems that surround them. AI must be finely tuned to those environments and evaluated within them so that its benefits and costs can be clearly understood and compared. As it stands, health systems are not set up to do that work, at least not across the board. Many are hiring more data scientists and engineers, but those specialists often work in self-contained units that help build or buy AI models and then struggle behind the scenes to keep them working properly. Each health system is kind of inventing this on their own, said Michael Dragulis, a data scientist at Hackensack Meridian Health System in New Jersey. He noted that the problems are not just technical, but also legal and ethical, requiring a broad group of experts to help address them. The Health AI Partnership's findings highlight the need for a more systematic approach to that work, especially amid the rush to harness the power of large language models, such as ChatGPT. The process shouldn't start with a press release, experts said, but with a deeper consideration of what problems AI can solve in healthcare and how to surround them with effective oversight. Many AI projects are undermined by ad hoc decision-making at the earliest stages, when hospitals are weighing whether to use an internally developed AI tool or one built by an outside vendor to improve some aspect of care or operations. A clinician's financial or personal ties to a particular company can interfere with objective assessments of its benefits and risk. And even when no such conflict exists, it can still be difficult to tell whether a tool developed by an outside vendor will work within a given health system. Many AI products, even if approved by the Food and Drug Administration, don't come with detailed documentation that would help health systems assess whether they will work on their patients or within their IT systems, where data must flow easily between record-keeping software and AI models. Many vendors of commercially available AI systems do not disclose how their products were trained or the gender, age, and racial makeup of the testing data. In many cases, it is also unclear whether the data they employ will map to those routinely collected by healthcare providers. And any of those that, of you that have ever worked in healthcare know that the data systems, often they have multiple data systems that are incompatible with one another, and a single provider might have to access several data systems in order to do their work. So that is a huge problem. The evaluation of AI systems often leaves hospitals with a limited understanding of how they perform in live clinical situations when data are messy or incomplete and sometimes skewed by bias. Most studies of AI systems rely on a series of statistical measures meant to gauge their accuracy in predicting which patients will experience a certain outcome, such as a rapid deterioration or death. But interviews conducted with caregivers, data scientists, and bioethicists expose widespread discomfort with the amount of faith placed in numbers that don't necessarily reflect the reliability of a given AI system or its ultimate impact. In some instances, an AI could lead to faster tests or speed the delivery of certain medicines, but still may not save any more lives. When AI systems go off the rails, troubleshooting the problem is rarely intuitive. It requires tracing errors to their source within a complex software system, where simple changes in the way data are recorded can throw off a model's calculations. Steve Miff, CEO of the Parkland Center for Clinical Innovation, the data science arm of the Parkland Public Health System in Dallas, Texas, recalled getting a text message on Saturday from a trauma surgeon working with an AI model designed to predict mortality risk for patients in the emergency department. The message simply asks, "Does the model take the weekend off?" Physicians found that the AI meant to help triage patients and gauge their stability had suddenly crashed. Miff said the issue was traced to a password change that altered the flow of data into the model. It was quickly fixed, he said, but the problem highlighted the bigger challenge of maintaining the system in a fast-changing environment. We have to be on top of this, because this is something that they're incorporating into their decision-making. When it stops working, it's disruptive. Establishing that kind of surveillance is particularly difficult in health systems where IT specialists, data scientists, and clinicians work in separate departments that don't always communicate about how their decisions might affect the performance of an AI model. Wow. Good deep dive into the challenges of AI in healthcare. Okay, next up is our last segment, bonus articles. A carefully curated combinations of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. I have 25 bonus articles this week. First up, how journalists can cover RFK Jr.'s anti-vax presidential run responsibility. So this is more of a health communication journalist article, and it's really important, and it's a good time for me to reflect and share a little bit about my view here at Just for the Health of It, is I don't report a lot trying to counteract myths and misinformation, because unfortunately one of the main principles of propaganda is repeating something people believe it, even if it's in the context that is completely false. Just being exposed to it over and over again, the brain tends to see that repetition as the fact that it appears in reality more often, that it appears more true. So that's one reason why I don't recover a lot of it. This article gets into a lot about how you can actually report and think about this anti-vax presidential run, which is going to capture some attention and responsibly cover it. Bonus article two. Challenging the FDA's authority isn't new. The agency's history shows what's at stake when drug regulation is in limbo. So the FDA, of course, has its own problems, but this is a good review of the agency's history and some of the things that are happening in society and politics when big changes were made in Food and Drug Administration regulations. And bonus article three relates to that. Roadside drug tests used to convict people aren't particularly accurate. Courts are beginning to prevent their use. Just an example of how, in this case, roadside drug tests aren't particularly useful, meaning accurate. And as we understand in the courts, Most cases are plead out. There's never actually a trial. So these scientifically invalid or inaccurate tests are often be used to plead out cases when in fact there might be actually false results and such. Bonus article 4. Finding the origin of a pandemic is difficult. Preventing one shouldn't be. Another backgrounder piece on the fact of how important surveillance is and a little bit of the distraction of trying to find the origin of a pandemic. It's worthwhile to do, but hopefully we can chew gum and walk at the same time. But surveillance really should be a no-brainer and is our best hope at preventing a future pandemic. And somewhat related to that, bonus article 5, as federal emergency declaration expires, the picture of the pandemic grows fuzzier. So our ability to track the pandemic is about ready to fall off a cliff. Fuzzy might be generous. And partly we're going to be flying blind here. And of course, it reinforces the idea the pandemic's over and we're not measuring it. A common political strategy for obfuscating problems. Don't measure it and it doesn't exist. And of course, that relates to surveillance of the epidemic too. The CDC is still doing surveillance on different variants and such, but that's going to be much more limited than it was in the recent past. Bonus article 6. Latest polling on American support for abortion rights. We're at an all-time high or near high, and this helps elucidate some of the contours of that battle going on right now. Bonus article 7. Immense and needless suffering. Idaho's abortion ban is creating a crisis of care. So this is a good early test case with only a year post-Roe. We're seeing that particularly rural areas like Idaho, with their very rigorous and criminalizing abortion ban, it's causing healthcare providers, particularly maternal healthcare providers, to leave. They're looking at like basically losing half of their maternal healthcare experts in the state because of criminalizing that care that's considered standard nationwide. Bonus article 8, lawyers suggest off-label use as a way around abortion pill restrictions, but doctors may be afraid to try it. So in the ensuing chaos after post-Roe, this is another workaround and backstop that might be available in case kind of the crazy judges get their way and the FDA loses its approval. Doctors do have the authority to use pills off-label, and in fact, there's some drugs that are used almost exclusively off-label, as it may be. Another interesting thing when you're looking at the FDA, but that's the reality that we live with today. And in a somewhat related article here, sticking to sort of obstetrics, Article 9, obstetric racism prevalent in the U.S., fueling rise in questionable labor inductions. So basically the story here is that labor inductions have been growing more and more common in the last few decades. This is driven mostly by white women, but the reality of what white women are experiencing and the reasons you have labor inductions isn't necessarily true for women of color, and it might not serve their interests, their children, or families' interests well, which of course reveals itself as obstetric racism. Turning to environmental news, bonus article 10, microplastics in Lake Erie highlight growing concern over potential health effects. So the concentrations of microplastics in Lake Erie is similar to that what's in the Great Pacific Garbage, what do they call it, a lake or whatever it is. It's like two times the size of Texas floating around in the Pacific Ocean. So there's a lot of microplastics in Lake Erie, basically like plastic bags, that type of thing that are out strewn around. They actually dissolve relatively soon, but into little tiny microplastics, which have large potential health effects, which we're just learning about. Another climate change story, bonus article 11, adults are getting allergies for the first time. Thanks, climate change. So it's that time of year, and allergy season has grown by about 3 weeks, in the last decade or two, and the amount of pollen that's being thrown up in the air is about 20% higher. So people who may not have had problems before because of the longer season and higher concentrations of pollen are suffering from allergies. Bonus article 12, good news story. Led by students, a nascent climate movement is taking hold in medical education. So one of the great shifts, I think, in public health and medical culture is that climate change is actually becoming a medical issue, and it first became a public health issue, but actually is becoming more and more a medical issue. So younger students are actually having a movement to make sure that climate change is a factor that's considered in medical education. The allergies story right before it relates to that as well. Let's turn to some healthcare issues. Bonus Article 13, how a 2019 Florida law catalyzed a hospital building boom. So there, a lot of states have had rules that basically require you have to demonstrate that there's a need for a hospital before you build it. Wow, that's a crazy thought. Ohio had this but lost it in the mid-late 90s. And we've had a lot more hospitals built. If you're wondering why there's more hospitals now with no more population in Toledo over the last 20 plus years, that's because they got rid of that law, and you can build a hospital for any reason. Most often competition and profit, not actually patient need. And we end up building excess capacity, and brick and mortar things are very expensive and raise healthcare costs. Bonus Article 14, physician-owned hospitals may not be good for healthcare. So some people might think that worker-owned hospitals is a good idea, but when it's physician-owned, first of all, it sets up a sort of a conflict of interest because they're primarily owners and investors trying to make a profit rather than try healthcare. But there's also a lot of you set up the healthcare and the physician model specifically because physicians control a lot of what's provided in healthcare, even driven more towards profit. Yikes. Bonus Article 15, health groups sound the alarm over foreign nurse visa freeze. So we're losing the access to tens of thousands of nurses each year because there aren't visas available for them to come in. And like much of our immigration system, it's crazy complicated. In order to get a foreign nurse visa, there has to be openings at the time that you apply and the time that you have the application looked at, which can be a long time. So if that takes more than about 8 or 9 months, for instance, this year, they basically have already run out of foreign visas. So if you had put in your visa request in October, you actually have to put it in again because you missed out this round. Crazy. And of course, that's going to harm healthcare providers' availability in the U.S. Bonus Article 16. There's a surprisingly easy way to avoid a huge number of major amputations, and that is multidisciplinary collaboration. So by doing multidisciplinary collaboration, the author of this article in that program that he was involved with showed a 75% reduction in the amount of amputations they did simply by spending some people time, some staff time with their own expertise in a multidisciplinary fashion to look at can they avoid amputation, which of course is a life-changing event, and many people with major amputations die within 5 years after their amputation, driven by some of those changes. Bonus Article 17, when patient questions are answered with higher quality and empathy by ChatGPT than physicians. So this is another deep dive of the follow-up of that story that I reported in my regular reporting about the higher quality and empathy that ChatGPT had over physicians. If you're interested in that, great read. Bonus Article 18, study finds stool transplants more effective than antibiotics for treating recurring life-threatening gut infections. So, duh. Now, stool transplants is kind of a freaky thing for a lot of people, but it's actually putting in good bacteria rather than just wiping out pretty much everything with antibiotics. It's not surprising that that works better, but this is an area of study that's evolving and practice. And Bonus Article 19 relates that first pill for fetal transplants wins FDA approval. So there is FDA approval of fecal transplants. This is the first one for a pill that you can take orally because most fecal transplants are not taken orally. And that's not as inviting for most patients and providers. Bonus Article 20. We're using less energy when we rest than we did 30 years ago. So they're not sure the reason why this is, but this, I suspect, and I've looked at this a lot as my expertise is in public health nutrition, is I expect that the chemical environment we're in with hormone-altering chemicals in the environment that we're actually seeing our metabolisms changed. Not good news. And sticking with obesity theme, bonus article 21. We've had a cheaper, more potent Ozempic alternative for decades, bariatric surgery, or better known as just weight loss surgery, where they mess around with the stomach or the intestine. It actually costs like $15,000, $25,000, which is not cheap, although pretty cheap for surgery. But there's like Ozempic and other drugs. These are like $10,000, $12,000 per year, and you basically can't get off them. So much more expensive in the long run and have a lot of side effects. Of course, bariatric surgery can have side effects too, but it's actually been shown to be pretty effective in weight loss and a lot more than the 20% weight loss that you see with these drugs. Article 22, another really interesting one. Industrialization bad for brain aging as shown by indigenous communities. So this is looking at a couple indigenous communities in lowland Bolivia compared to like Western societies. And the one indigenous community has more contact, is sort of a hybrid between modern society and completely indigenous, you know, going native or whatever, where you don't have a lot of technology and industrialization. And it basically shows that even a moderate amount of industrialization is bad for your brain health. And of course, that's true for many other things too. The brain is a canary in the coal mine. If your brain ain't doing good, your heart probably isn't either, for instance. Bonus article 23, Biden run fuels age debate. Experts weigh in on octogenarian health. So this is just a good backgrounder on the health issues that are faced by aging folks, particularly octogenarians, those 80 plus. And one of the things to remember is that health begins to vary even more within a population as people age. So it's hard to make overall generalizations. 24, how to grow your social network as you age. Just another good backgrounder and a reminder that social connection is really important for your health, particularly as you age. And lastly, but not least, bonus article 25, self-test for adult symptom deficiency disorder, ASDD. Warning, this contains satire. This is kind of a joke, but it's very serious in kind of making fun of psychiatry that basically they have so many disorders that virtually everybody will have a diagnosable mental health disease at some point in their life. Yikes. You can read these and all the stories I reported on this episode and the 208 before it at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's T-O-P. PUN.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-